Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We are talking about the state of England's towns in the late 20th century, in fact, running up to the present day. And last time we were talking about pollution, which obviously is an important issue. And I think it's fair to say that the traffic calming schemes of councils, for example, London or indeed Exeter, have greatly increased pollution because by slowing down vehicles, they ensure that they, you know, spend more time on the road and produce more pollution. But now I wish to switch and talk a bit about housing, which remains a key issue and indeed has been one of the major themes in what we've been talking about in the 19th and 20th century. The administration of Mrs. Thatcher from 1979 to 1988 was obviously extremely important in housing. We've already discussed the impact of council house sales, but there was more than that. For example, the 1988 Housing Act allowed housing associations to borrow privately, as opposed to relying on government loans, which led to a rapid expansion of housing association provision, over £70 billion in borrowing to the present. This is an important aspect of what you might call the public-private partnership, or, more fairly, the private sector sorting out the problems for government, and, of course, local authorities and central government, that they couldn't build as effectively and administer as effectively. So housing associations, which were part, if you wish to look at it, of a corporatist state or looked at it more favourably, were actually an example of a legal status for private finance. Housing associations provided an important addition. And now it's worth saying that although housing association provision rose, there was an even greater fall in local authority provision. Local authorities saw their housing stock decline over a 30-year period from a peak of 4.99 million units, so a unit would be a house or a flat, to 1.73. Now, housing associations increased in the same period from 281,000, so really a rather minor role, to 2.4 million in the period ending in 2012. But I think it's fair to say that there remained a housing crisis, even though the housing association's methods brought in a lot of private finance. Particular housing shortages developed for poor families, not least as inner city regeneration and new inner city housing focused on flats for single people, for childless couples or for students rather than for families. Indeed, that's interesting. In my city, Exeter, there has been a lot of tension, fair or unfair, we can discuss, as to whether the expansion of single person housing, notably but not only for students, has been at the expense of families. And interestingly enough, I mean, Exeter is a Labour-run city. This is part of the tension within the Labour Party, so that in some wards like St James's and Polslow, there has been a lot of antipathy to the council on the part of Labour voters to the Labour Council for giving planning permission for student housing, and the argument being that this reduces the opportunity for families. New housing provisions certainly remained inadequate in the 1990s, 2000 and 2010s, and despite the promises of politicians, then there is no sign of this situation changing. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that an aspect that wasn't brought out in the or not that I'm aware of, in the discussion of the recent budget by the Labour government, is that its harsh policies in terms of attitudes towards company profitability, not increasing the tax on employees paid by companies, will actually make housing starts much harder, because housing requires a large number of employees as builders, carpenters, etc. Alongside inadequacy, there was the issue of cost. And of course, the Labour budget is going to increase the cost of building a house. In 1986, the average first-time buyer paid just under £30,000 for a new home, whereas in 2015, the figure was over £150,000 for England as a whole and £330,000 in London. According to Nationwide, a building society, the average UK house price had risen to £196,930 by February 2016, a 60% increase in 13 years, and one that encouraged investment in housing, which drove up the cost as investment for renting out or for Airbnbs, also put up purchase prices. Sorry, I'm a bit tired, but the idea of a flying Airbnb being fitted into an Airbus I was on an aeroplane yesterday. It's too funny. The combined income impact was a fall in home ownership. Research by the Resolution Foundation, published in August 2016, indicated that home ownership in England, having peaked at 70.9% in October 2004, fell steadily, for example, to 63.8% by 2015. In other words, under both Labour and the Conservatives, the percentage was falling. And that might not sound much, but a 7% fall was very significant. It was roughly 10% of the population was moving from being homeowners to non-homeowners in England. And this was also the same level as in 1986, when the percentage had been 63.5%. Although then the number of owner-occupiers was lower as the population was lower, whereas the 1986 percentage was a rapid increase on that in 1980, when it had been closer to 57. So under Mrs. Thatcher, continuing under Mr. Major, there was a significant increase in the percentage of the population owning their own homes, and that has fallen since October 2004. First under Labour and then under the Conservatives. The housing crisis was not only seen in London, the place that I think it's fair to say overly dominates the news and political debate as it has long done. Outer London had a drop of 13.5% in home ownership from a peak of 71.4% in October 2000 to 57.8% in February 2016. The same trend was also the case elsewhere. In Greater Manchester, home ownership peaked in 2003 at 72.4%, but has since fallen to 57.9%, the biggest drop in the UK. And obviously, this is part and parcel of turning more of the population into, I think, renters, and therefore more of them to take a different view, I think it's fair to say, on political economy. The percentage falls in the West Midlands during that same period was 11.2%, in West Yorkshire 10.6%, and in Merseyside 9.1%. And there were sharp falls in, for example, Leeds and Sheffield. The mismatch of high house price increases well above those in incomes was crucial, as it made the large deposits required to purchase a new home increasingly unaffordable, and that despite government attempts to help. And those attempts could be dangerous by priming the market for first-time buyers and therefore pushing up the price. As a result, renting came to the fore, but very high rents in the private sector made it impossible for many to save for a deposit because they were obviously using their money in the meantime to pay the rent. The percentage renting privately in England, in other words, not from the council or the housing associations, rose from 11% in 2003 to 19% in 2015, while that in Greater Manchester rose from 6 to 20%, and both Outer London and West Yorkshire also saw the percentage rise by more than 10%. This long-term rise in the price of housing led in the early 21st century to an increase in intergenerational living, which was part of a global trend. For the benefit of listeners, intergenerational living means that you have the pleasure of living with your grandchildren or children. A 2016 report by Aviva forecasts that by 2025, there would be about 3.8 million 20 to 34-year-olds living with their parents, about 31% of the cohort. That compared to 1.9 million doing so in 2000 and 2.8 million doing so by 2015. Financial necessity, obviously a key element in this situation, because living with parents or grandparents made it easier to save to buy houses, as well as the common reasons of inability to afford rent and the need for help with childcare. The 2021 census revealed that in England and Wales, 77.9% of households lived in a house, 21.7% in flats, and 0.4% in caravans. Obviously, the criteria of what a house was, what a flat was, and what a caravan was could vary greatly. And in 2021, according to the census, 62.5% owned the property they lived in. So obviously, we're talking about a significant fall still, although as I imagine one can say a slow down fall. It had been 63.8% for 2015. 6 years later, it's 62.5%. Looked at differently, over 1% of the population is a significant number change in 6 years. And of course, the size of the population is growing at the same time. Pressure on housing was used as a reason not only for higher density housing, but also for building upwards, affecting long-standing vistas and shadowing neighbouring buildings, including houses, as for example in Exeter. By 2024, 107 of the 129 British buildings taller than St Paul's Cathedral were in London, with many more approved. Worth bearing in mind that Boris Johnson was one of the most egregious offenders on this when he was Mayor of London, the man that talked about tradition and heritage but did an enormous amount to trash both. Manchester followed, not least with the plan for a 241-metre high residential tower block, the tallest in Western Europe, as did Leeds. A letter published in The Times on the 15th of May 2024 included the following observation, which I think is a correct one, certainly based on my visits to Manchester. Quote, Manchester is a prime example of near identical tall buildings built like dominoes that are stacked so close together they suffocate the city. I would add they cut out the light. And they have teeny balconies all overlooking each other and resemble human versions of bird perches. Even worse, every piece of greenery has been removed. It has become a cement city in the sky. I think that's very true. Manchester, which in some respects deserves, rather than Middlesbrough, Gladstone's remark about the infant Hercules for the 19th century, Manchester is now a prosperous but very shoddy city. The residential in question was generally designed, notably so in London, for foreign investors. So of the 68 high-rise residential projects built in London in 2000 to 2023, 6% of the 22,000 housing units were listed as affordable and less than 1% as social housing for the poor. Not surprising, but again, illustration of the social structural political economy of housing. In June 2024, Labour's deputy leader, Angela Rayner, set out what she saw as indicative designs for new towns. Quote, and just bear this in mind when you wish to judge the success of the government we currently have. The towns for the future would include Edwardian-style mansion blocks, tree-lined streets of townhouses, not identikit homes and dingy shoeboxes, quote. And she claims that the 1.5 million homes to be built over 5 years would include only, quote, exemplary design with real character. Labour also offered a government mortgage guarantee scheme to provide loans of up to 95% of a property's value for first-time buyers. In contrast, in 2023, only 158,000 houses were completed. I think it's fair to say that within the industry, many people are highly sceptical of Rayner's claims and pretensions. But, you know, we shall wait and see what happens. But it is worth bearing in mind the promises of this government when you consider the situation when they come up to re-election. As a separate issue of urban strain, an increase in criminality, especially in contrast to the 1950s, 1950s are often condemned and held to be dull, etc., etc. Actually, for many people, the 1950s was a safer and more orderly place to live. This was related to a widespread breakdown subsequently in the socialisation of the young, especially of young males. The number and percentage of young men with criminal records rose, and it's worth bearing in mind it can be quite difficult to get a criminal record because of the abysmal nature of policing in a country, which is more concerned these days, in the case, unfortunately, of many police forces with tick boxing than it is with actually dealing with burglars, muggers and such like. Nevertheless, despite that, the percentage of young men with criminal records has rose, and there was also an increase for young women. Although crime was not limited to these areas, crime hit most in rundown neighbourhoods, further desocialising life there and encouraging outward movement by those who could afford it. This situation led to a greater measure of social segregation and was linked to the appeal of the suburbs. And this was true of both Labour governments and Conservative governments. A social trend for both was the social differentiation of, shall we say, upwardly mobile working class people who were successful moving out to suburbia. Although blamed, and indeed, I mean, you know, in my own family, now that I think about it, my father grew up in a not particularly desirable part of the East End. And for him, it was very important at the end of the 50s to move out to suburbia. And more interestingly, so it was for every single, he was one of eight children, for every single one of them. Although blamed by many commentators on Conservative governments between 79 and 97 and their economic policies, crime had in fact been increasing steadily before that. And indeed, it's worth, for example, in the 1960s, and it's worth bearing in mind, for much of the period, unemployment rates were low and the standard of living of the poor, in fact, rose. So the argument thrown against Mrs. Thatcher and the Conservatives that their supposedly harsh social policies, in particular policies and economic policies linked to rises in unemployment, were the cause of an increase in criminality, is rather extraordinary given the extent to which, you know, criminality also increased in periods that were somewhat different. So, for example, robberies in London rose by 105% between 1991 and 2002, a period of falling unemployment. It's worth bearing in mind that knife crime and a number of other crimes has risen considerably in recent years, where unemployment has also been quite low. Many commentators, however, found it easier to blame Mrs. Thatcher, the Conservatives, the system, or alleged racism. Similarly, in 2011 and 2016, rioting and looting in London took place in a city with very high rates of employment. In 2011, anger with the police and looting for consumer goods both played a role. The number of rioters was relatively low, but a delayed police response exacerbated the situation, and the rioters made good use of social media in order to organise and to thwart the police. I mean, it's interesting that if you take, for example, the riot moving up the A11 in East London, there was very little action by the police to stop the looters. But what happened at Dalston, where there's an appreciable Turkish Cypriot population who owned a lot of these small independent shops, is they lined up across the road carrying iron bars, and the rioters found it prudent not to proceed any further. It's rather dangerous for society if, in the end, individuals feel that they have to protect themselves, their family, and their businesses because they can't rely on the police to do so. Violence, of course, in 2011 spread to Birmingham and then to Manchester, Merseyside, and Nottingham. Five people were killed in the riots and over 3,000 people arrested. To cope with the situation, it was thought necessary to move police from elsewhere in the country, for example, where I live, leaving many other towns poorly policed for a while. More generally, there is a sense that policing is inadequate in many towns, notably small ones threatened by county line gangs, for example, Marlborough, as well as in some major ones where policing has been criticised as inadequate, for example, Nottingham, which is a very dangerous city. Drug use, as assessed by the Crime Survey for England and Wales, a government survey, reveals that low income itself is not the cause of crime. Figures published in July 2016 for the period 2015 to 16 indicated that 3% of people aged between 16 and 59 in households with an annual income of at least £50,000 said they had taken cocaine that year, and 2.2% ecstasy, up from 2.2 and 1.5% respectively the previous year, whereas the yet lower income drug usage was stable and falling. All of those were probably underestimates, of course. One in five people aged between 16 and 25 has, according to other figures, taken a drug in the past year, compared with one in four a decade earlier, cannabis being the most common drug. This usage contributed to the profitability of crime, which is one of the growth industries at the present moment. And of course, one of the paradoxical consequences of the increase in taxation on business by the Labour government is that increases further the appeal of, for those who have, shall we say, mores and methods of a certain type of investing in crime rather than in trying to wash their money through legitimate businesses. One novelist observed of Southampton in 2024, organized crime group, one of the most common reasons for crime in the city, drugs, money, gambling. In practice, an explanation of rising crime in London and elsewhere in terms of unemployment appears less pertinent than one that focuses on social dislocation, especially family breakdown. In addition, and I mean, classically, the absent father is a real problem, and the poorly socialized children, and mothers having multiple partners, I mean, in sequence, and children often being disaffected. In addition, detailed variations chronologically owed much to changing age profiles in the shape of the number of adolescent males, a group that's more likely to commit crime. So knife crime became more prominent in London in the 2000s, in part because large numbers of young men began to carry knives in order to give themselves a sense of protection. The resulting killings led to a change in the age profile of violent death among males. On the other hand, the murder rate was low by global standards and certainly compared to the United States, and that despite the fact that the country was relatively crowded, while imprisonment was also less common than in America. I mean, you know, a lot of criminals are literally let back onto the streets. Again, this government has been doing that. And nevertheless, the murder rate is still relatively low by global standards. The low rate of gun ownership, and notably of the legal ownership of guns, was an important factor in keeping the murder rate low, though there were notable issues in specific communities, and black-on-black killings among young men in London, often with guns, caused concern. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Black Lives Matter, in response to the murder of George Floyd in the United States, was a big issue in Britain at the beginning of the 2020s, And of course, it is shameful when there is police misconduct of that type. But of course, police murdering the public is not a commonplace in Britain, and most black killings are by other blacks. But that, which is not good or bad, it's just what happens. As indeed, we have crime with other within other ethnic groups, but that did not seem to engage the attention of the public to the comparable extent. As so often, the weather played a role. In 2016, disturbances in London occurred on the hottest day of the year up to then, with temperatures peaking at 33.5 degrees centigrade. Although, on the other hand, when temperatures rose even more later that very summer, there were no riots. There are also issues with the wider reporting of crime and of low conviction rates. And reporting issues have led to dissension about what are the real crime rates, notably for robbery. In particular, it's been claimed that downward trends in police figures for many crimes are misleading. Certainly, low conviction rates may well affect people's willingness to report crime. It may be a factor in people's willingness to report muggings, for example, or much more seriously, rape. Whereas the insurance issue appears to encourage people to report burglary. In some urban areas, there have been major moral panics, especially about paedophilia in the 2000s and 2010s, and about the large-scale exploitation of girls, particularly girls in local authority care in the 20-teens. Worth bearing in mind that if these had been young people in the care of the private sector, as opposed to under local authority supervision, there would have been almost certainly much more of a political fuss. And again, that's a very interesting comment that's worth bearing in mind. The term moral panic is frequently employed by academics as a distancing one that implies that the situation has been exaggerated in order to make moral or political points. In practice, both paedophilia and the grooming of children for sexual exploitation were revealed as very major problems. In part, they were linked to new technology in the shape of child pornography on the internet. But ethnic tension also played a major role, with young white girls in care in certain northern towns, notably Rotherham, but also elsewhere in the country, for example, in Derby, in Oxford, in Rochdale, being exploited, and mostly by Asian Muslim men who used intimidation, rape, and getting young women addicted to drugs. Trial testimony suggested that the accused regarded white women as inherently sluttish and therefore ripe for brutal exploitation. For long, commentators wouldn't refer to these issues for fear of being labelled as racist, and the same factor appears to have affected the police. As a result, the scandal when the stories broke in the 20-teens and many towns were revealed to have such gangs reflected on the major problems England faced in looking at the nature of its society, and also should not be pushed under the carpet if one is trying to offer an urban history of England. The official report on Rotherham suggested that 1,400 girls had been exploited there. An astonishing number. Failures to act on the part of local authorities and the police called justified outrage, although possibly not the level of public anger and action that would have been seen in some countries. There was less of a sustained panic about the deadly suicide bomb attacks on the London Tube and bus system by Islamic extremists in 2005. A febrile atmosphere, which was exacerbated by the hunt for other would-be bombers, highlighted worries that a traditional tolerance, and especially the openness to immigrants and multiculturalism, might be sowing the seeds for sustained problems. But that anxiety was not allowed to capture the public mood. Now, I'm going to move on next time from crime to COVID, but I think we could stop at this particular moment.
Yes, thank you, Jeremy. And a number of questions present themselves. Obviously, been discussing two themes in this podcast. The first part about home ownership and different forms of living in houses, and the second part about crime. I want to just raise a point for discussion about the home ownership first. And I wonder whether, you know, from a historical perspective, we could say the period from about the 1960s through to the first years of the 21st century were unusual in Britain, which is to say it was an unusually high period of home ownership. If you go back to the Edwardian period, almost 80-90% of British people are living in rented accommodation, private rented accommodation. And over the course of the 20th century, home ownership rises and then stalls early in this century and goes into reverse. I wonder if you see, this is partly a historical question, partly a question to you, foresee how things develop from the current situation, whether we could or should go back to the higher home ownership, or are simply the other pressures, demographic and economic, now make that almost impossible, particularly at the time when the period of encouraging private landlords again, which has been a policy for the last 30, 40 years, has ended. It's now burdens are being placed on private landlords. So we're not building the homes for the private sector. We're not giving incentives for private landlords. Where do we go from here? And does that have a historical echo?
Well, I obviously don't know where we're going to go from here because I'm a historian. I really don't know. I mean, what I would say is I think that the essential understanding of society offered by Margaret Thatcher, which was that a society that is more stable if people in it feel that they have a stake in that society, I think that's absolutely true.
Yes. That's quite a British perspective, though, isn't it? Because, you know, Germany, home ownership in modern Germany, I think, is about 46-47%.
And yet, I'm not saying that's the, can I just say,
plenty of people vote for Christian Democrats.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's the only definition of a stake in society. I'm simply saying it's an aspect of a sense of a stake in society. Now, stakes in society come from very many reasons and very many factors, but that I think is an important aspect of it.
Yeah, the other thing that really strikes me about ownership and also new development in recent years, you mentioned the increase again of tower blocks in Manchester and London. It seems to you we went through a phase in the 1960s of thinking tower blocks were the answer, and then we went through about 25 years of disparaging tower blocks as not the answer. And now we're going back to tower blocks again. How did that happen? And why has there not been an effective pushback against returning to some of the, what was seen to be the failed urban developments of the 60s?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, my own view, for what it is worth, is that the argument for development has trumped all other concerns about viability. So viability is a whole host of things. I mean, obviously, very tall buildings pose many more problems structurally in terms of moving people through lift systems, in terms of almost all of them don't have windows that open, etc., etc., etc. So I think there are major practical problems here. But obviously, you've got this idea of growth. I use the term vertical growth, and I imagine that many cities will continue along that line. I mean, paradoxically, working away from home means that, you know, working from home means there's going to be less of a pressure for these very high buildings for office purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Well, I want to conclude by just picking again your brain on the subject of crime. And of course, discussing crime, these are all, you know, questions of law and order, as well as the nature of towns. But the two are inevitably entwined. About 20 years ago, there was a 20, 25 years ago, there was a movement towards what was called the broken windows policy of policing, in which what was seen as minor crimes, vandalism, and so on, were suddenly they were vigorously investigated by the police on the grounds that small crimes lead to a sense of disorder, which then lead to larger crimes. That period did coincide, and there may have been other factors, but it did coincide with a period of declining crime. And now we have a situation where that policy seems to be entirely abandoned without anyone announcing the fact. The city I live in, I live a few streets away from the main police station. In 5 years of living there, I've not seen a single policeman on the streets. Crime is soaring. None of the crimes are solved. It's like the police have given up. I mean, what they are doing, we can debate, but they don't seem to be on the streets. They don't seem to be policing day-to-day criminality.
Well, I think there are many anxieties about what the police are actually doing. I mean, I think, again, one saw this both the last government, the Conservative government, and with the current Labour government. And in particular, there's been, I mean, we're talking at the present moment in November 2024, there is great anxiety about the amount of police time being spent on pursuing what are held to be hate crimes, but are simply often expressions of personal like or dislike, and not dealing with often the harder matters of, you know, habitual criminality. And this is obviously linked as well to a crisis in the provision, again, one in which I think it's fair to say both political parties play a role, the provision of adequate prison space. So I think there is a degree of public scepticism and anxiety. The problem for government, I don't wish to catastrophize this, I just simply wish to observe this, and this is not something I wish to happen, but obviously there is an implicit contract that government will protect people, that in return for that, they don't need to protect themselves. One has to wonder whether that may fray that implicit bargain. One might argue it's already frayed in the case of so-called communities, often of an ethnic character, which in effect have a form of policing or intimidation, whatever you want to call it, in certain environments, certain neighbourhoods. You could argue that in some areas, drug gangs provide not just a profit for themselves, but a very rough and ready control over the criminality of others. You could argue that that's what the provisional IRA did with its vicious processes. You know, it would do kneecapping on people who were habitual criminals. So I think it's of great concern for all of us, anxious as we should be that law and order is maintained, to see that the police coping with what most of us would understand as criminality. And there is a real problem of a democratic deficit in a country in which there has been criminality redefined as matters of opinion rather than matters of real physical hurt.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a punchy point on which to end. Next time we'll be talking about towns in a time of COVID, but for talking about housing, home ownership, and for crime in the 21st century English town, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.